Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to take about 5 minutes while members join. So I just wanted to call this meeting to order at 3:31 p.m. I will take a brief at ease as members continue to join committee. Thank you. Brief at ease. It is Monday, February 5th, 2024. I called the meeting to order at 3:31 p.m. Members present are Representative Vance, Representative Baker, Representative Dibert, Representative Carrick, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, as always, as I will do right now. Make sure that your phone is off. We have a strict donut policy, for those who aren't aware already. I've made that joke so many times. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Annie Goodenough, the House Tribal Affairs Committee Secretary from Records, and Shelby Carroll from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. We've got a lot of guests today. We are joined by James Cockrell, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, Darlene Dye, Tribal Liaison, Department of Public Safety, Lance Dulkey, MMIP Investigator, Department of Public Safety, Lonnie Piscoya, MMIP Investigator, Department of Public Safety, Tammy Truitt-Giroux, Executive Director of Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, Joel Jackson, President of the Organized Village of Cake, Dr. Charlene Okpik-Apok, Executive Director and Co-Founder, Data for Indigenous Justice, Kendra Kloster, Co-Director for Law and Policy for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Today, the presentation will be covering something that's of great importance to my region, but I think the state of Alaska overall. As we've seen a number of cases near Bethel this summer and around the state. So I just want to really reiterate that I think this will be very personal for a lot of us. And so I hope everyone, and I will do this as chair, I just hope everyone approaches this with the patience necessary to talk about what we're about to talk about today. But with that aside, again, for the purpose of time, I will hold all presentations until, excuse me, hold all questions until the presentation is over. So now we have joined with us at the table our first presenter, Tammy Truitt-Giroux, the Executive Director of Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Would you please put your name on the record and begin your presentation?
I think this is on, yes? Okay. Tammy Truitt-Giroux, and I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. And I've been doing this type of work in domestic violence and gender-based violence and sexual violence and a lot of intersecting issues for well over 40 years. And because of that, I think this was the next step, is trying to start changing it from within in terms of our communities. So our main office is in Fairbanks, and we have several other staff members around the state, both in Anchorage and Hoonah, Angoon, and several other places. So we're really happy to do that. The Alaska Native Women's Resource Center came to be because of domestic violence advocates that were doing their work in their community with no support. Most of these folks, we were all working in very small villages, which we didn't have a whole lot of options in terms of where people could go for safety. We didn't, most of our communities and people that were involved in the making up the resource center really were looking for a different way to access services, because there wasn't enough access and folks were going no place to go. They were living, they were hiding in abandoned houses and other things. There was not a lot of areas available to get them out for services, you know, with the flying and the cost of flying and the cost of just trying to get the service into many of our communities. So I think there was a lot of, after the vow in 2013, there was a lot of concern that Alaska was left out of that very important legislation when it came to Indian tribes and the ability to start governing our own methods of both accountability, but also our own methods of being able to access services for victim survivors that needed that. There's been many changes since then, but in 2015, we were able to finally become a nonprofit. And in becoming a nonprofit, we then began looking at doing training and technical assistance with the 229 tribes in this state that were able to then make our own, help people to find our answers. We know that the tribes had those answers. They just hadn't had the resources or sometimes the infrastructure to start making the changes. And I think with the resource center and our ability to work from with some of our federal partners and also looking at what our sovereignty meant for the tribes in this state in terms of healing and to change that victim, the victim numbers that we have in this state, particularly against Alaska Native people.
And if I may, just for the record, I neglected to note, I apologize. We are joined by both Representative Himshute and Representative Scroggie. I believe they're here at about 3:35. But I just wanted to also mention you are more than welcome to take a seat here at the table. And if there are any questions you'd like to ask, by all means, please feel free to join us and ask those questions. Thank you.
Is that close enough? Okay. So the one issue is, why do we bring up gender-based violence and then talk about missing and murdered Indigenous people? Well, there's a direct correlation between murdered individuals, survivors, or not survivors, absolutely, but victims of domestic violence, that the ultimate, of course, trauma is death in those situations. So it's really important that we understand that, and that is part of what the missing and murdered Indigenous people represents, and the fact that oftentimes communities they experience the highest rates of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking, sex trafficking, even labor trafficking. We know this to be true even from the limited data, and that is something that we talk a lot about in the meetings that we're having with legislators and with other organizations, is that data is really important in this, and unfortunately data has been very challenging to come up with that data, and I think that's changing here in the state. I think there's been a lot of proactive movement towards that, but there's a lot of work to do. And oftentimes the reason that data is important is oftentimes the funding that we are trying to receive it at the tribal level, they want to know the numbers. Well, unfortunately, Alaska ends up being one of the top numbers in these horrible statistics in all areas. And so this is another way of hopefully helping to make those numbers less, because all those numbers are people. They're not just numbers. They're people. You know, they're our relatives. We have to remember that. I think that there's many things being done to address the MMIP crisis. I remember 10 years ago when we were having these conversations, and just from 10 years to today and what's happening here with the legislative fly-in that was organized by the MMIP 2G working group, is that we're here in front of you and being able to talk about this. We're able to then tell the stories that need to be told. But the unfortunate piece of that is that it's not necessarily stopping it, which we need to do, but at least you're hearing us. And that's a very important thing that didn't happen 10 years ago. I know that it's challenging to understand why there are so many, why the statistics are so high. And you know, there's a lot of slides here that can talk to you about that. But really what the issue is that through colonization and through the lack of truly collaborative relationships with our tribes, that's where it's a very high number, and a lot of that has to do with some of those relationships. Again, I think that's changing, And I think that's changing just being here today. I also think it's changing that we're able to have these conversations because we do want to work with state partnerships for people that are living in our communities, both and our urban areas, to have access to services that they need to either recover or stop or be able to be safe. One of the efforts that was made was a federal law called the Not Invisible Act, and they formed a commission, and that commission was made up of a very diverse group of people, federal partners from different agencies, the Department of Interior and the Department of Justice, federal partners. There were federal partners from the CDC. There was federal partners from other departments at the federal level. There were family members of people who had gone missing and hadn't been found at this point. There were family members of people who had been sex trafficked. There were actually survivors of sex trafficking. There were advocacy groups. There were tribal court and law enforcement, both from a tribal lens and a non-tribal lens. So there's 44 people on this commission. And we went and had 7 very, very intense hearings around the country, including Alaska. And I think that what I would bring to this conversation is some of the commission report had some very proactive requests for change. Unfortunately, as of today's date, we haven't had a response from the Department of Interior or the Department of Justice. But what it did do is that we were able to come together as one body, and it was very amazing how that happened. I also think it was a very life-changing experience listening to the bravery of these families that came before us all over the country. And unfortunately, we were hearing the same things. There was a lot of concern about response from law enforcement. There was a lot of concerns about response, like Amber Alerts and other alerts in Indian Country. There was a lot of real concerns about how proactive law enforcement was, and this was across the spectrum of law enforcement. And there was a lot of concerns that there were no services or support types of advocacy available to families that really had no place to go. I think we did 7 field hearings. We had 8 full commission meetings and a total of 119 subcommittee meetings from 6 subgroups. And the 6 subgroups were really looking at specific areas, data being one, advocacy perspective, a law enforcement perspective, a prosecution perspective. But these perspectives came together and, like I said, we had representation from a very diverse group of people. And so it was important that we had to try to come to some commonality in terms of writing this report. But the one thing that stood out was that we had to do a special chapter on Alaska. And we had to do a special chapter on Alaska because the impacts in Alaska are still extreme in the bigger scheme of things. And because of that, they also, the isolation and the other areas that have real concern about trying to find people that have gone missing and the response time. I wanted to bring up just a few common themes that I thought were of value. This report is available online. One of the common themes was funding, of course. It's always about funding, isn't it? Because a lot of these initiatives, if you have to pay your officers and you have to pay for support services or for mental health services or advocacy, you know, having a base funding to tribes to battle MMIP and human trafficking, that was one of the themes. There was a lot of themes around accountability. And the accountability was not even just through prosecution or systems. It was actually accountability in our home communities. There needed to be accountability for these people that we knew, they knew who had done this. And there were missteps, and this was a constant theme over and over and over again. And it was just, it was so heartbreaking because I thought we were hearing the same people in, you know, seven different places in the United States that were surrounded by or in Indian country or Alaska Native villages. Returning jurisdictions to the sovereigns. And that has a lot of different meanings for a lot of different people. But jurisdiction to sovereign tribal governments also helps put the responsibility on those governments as well as the other responsible governments, whether that's a state or federal. And so that has, I think that there's some real benefit to that in that collaborative and way that can be more useful because we can't all be living and working in these silos because that's not working. And as I pointed out, Alaska requires some very focused solutions. and this is written right from the field hearings that, you know, we have ethnically and culturally and linguistically really diverse nations. And we, as we all know, living in this great state, we have a lot of virgin land. There's a whole lot of miles that there's nothing going on. But I think that the most important part of that is that it's almost like some of our Alaska Native villages are no man's land when it comes to law enforcement and authority. And I think sometimes living in those communities, and I've lived in a couple of them, where when law enforcement does respond, no one's talking because they've been getting away with it. So I'm not putting that down, but I'm saying that's part of the system change within all of our other systems that can also help bridge that gap. We need to bridge that gap in terms of accountability and how that looks and how we can work together to do that. I don't know if that's a popular stance or not. That's my personal opinion. And we need to change this high victimization rate. I don't want to be at the top of that scale. I don't want my children to be at the top of that scale. I don't want my granddaughter to have to sit here and tell you that I'm hunted in this state. That's not okay. And data and coordination was another really big concern because across these different communities, it felt sometimes like we were sitting in Alaska Village listening to some of the testimony that people were sharing. There's a lot of differences, but there's so many similarities. One being an American Indian or Alaska Native person makes you a target. Communication, victim and family support. That was another really big one, is having a support for both search and rescue, for support for mental health support, advocacy support, even trying to help a lot of the people that came to testify from far away from wherever we were doing our hearings, had to pay their own way. They had no funding in order to do that, but they wanted to be heard, even though they hadn't felt heard by a lot of people. And the law enforcement shortages, trying to really address the law enforcement shortages and how do we help change that with the high turnover in law enforcement? And how do we also help law enforcement be trained to be able to respond to some of these horrendous things? But the other piece of that is how do we keep law enforcement? A lot of times tribal law enforcement do not have any kind of retirement or benefit systems. There's all kinds of things that contribute to that lack of law enforcement. One being, of course, in this today's society, it seems like that's not a very popular job to have right now. And I understand that. But we also know that that's one of the key resources needed when we start looking at someone who's been murdered and is being termed undetermined because they can't get anybody in there to do the evidence collection or do the things they need to do. There's all kinds of reasons why law enforcement needs to be a partner in this, in the answer. I'm just going to make sure that I don't go over here. The other piece was media. And I'm sure you've heard this before. If a non-Native person goes missing, unfortunately, it seems like media is much more on the spot in advertising that than a Native person. And that's been a pretty consistent message that we have gotten over the, just look at the TV news. And there's a couple of very high profile cases that, again, recently that have been in the news about that. And we don't need to revisit that. It's just, it's a fact. It's just a fact. Addressing the vulnerabilities. Of course, a lot of times that people, Alaska Native people are targeted because of the vulnerabilities that may exist in, whether it's their family system, in their own community, whether it's through trauma that has been impacted them from their childhood or through their families going on, or even their communities. We have human traffickers, they're preying on the vulnerability. And they know all of the resources to go get. I mean, the computer programs, the things, how to access children through those. All of these things seem to be, I don't know if they have a school for people to, perpetrate against other people. It's very, very scary. And part of that, I think, is that we have to address the trauma, because we have the idea of resiliency. So addressing the trauma and healing from the trauma, and that's all people, that makes you a less of a target. All right. So I think there's a lot of things that are happening that, again, are really positive here. We have a lot of partnerships right now, working with many organizations and trying to make actions at every level, whether that's local, tribal, state, federal, and we even do some, we've even been on the international stage trying to just, because this isn't just Indigenous people or women in this United States or Alaska, it's also in other places that are also experiencing this. Thank you.
I would just like to briefly note for the record, we were joined by Representative Carpenter at 3:51 p.m. Welcome, Rep. Carpenter. Are there any questions from members? Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Wu, thank you so much for your presentation today and in House Judiciary for Human Trafficking Week. Your insight and experience into this is very helpful. I have a specific question on page 4 of your slide where it's introduction to MMIP. On the statistics that you show, would you explain this further? Is this all of Native women or 94% of missing and murdered Indigenous women?
This is actually, from my understanding, is missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but the statistic is across Alaska Native American Indian people. So 94% is based, or they've been coerced in their lifetime, not just missing and murdered, but myself, other people, relatives, the whole population.
Thank you for that. And for
follow up,
for all of it, I just say it louder for those in the back.
Thank you.
Are there any additional questions or comments? Ms. Drew, thank you very much for your presentation. If you wouldn't mind just hanging around, we might have more questions that come up towards the end. Thank you. We welcome to the table now President Jackson, if you would come forward. And I think I should just also warn you, a lot of people smack their knees on this table, so just be forewarned that you don't do that.
Love these chairs. For the record, my name is Joel Jackson. I'm the president of the Organized Village of Cake from Cake, Alaska. I was invited to join this organization to come here and talk about the tribal side of what's going on in the villages like mine. We have less than 500 people there. We recently got two new BPSOs, which is great. They're both currently in the academy in Sitka. I guess they're going to be there for like 9 weeks. But in the meantime, we're back to the same old. I think we have other VPSOs that come from other villages. I think they got a 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. So, you know, we're usually without anybody in cake, any VPSOs for like 2 weeks. So it's, I mean, we've been talking about this forever, seem like. It just, it's sad because we've lost, and I told this story many, many times, too many times. We lost two beautiful girls, young girls. One of them lay in the back entrance of a church, a local church there, for almost 16 hours. I know the Department of Public Safety will say, no, that wasn't that long, but I was there. And that was unacceptable. This isn't an isolated case. There's other communities that experience the same thing. And I use the comparison of the, if a moose or a deer was shot out of season, it'd probably take the brown shirts 2 hours to get there with a full squad of fish and game officials or officers. That's unacceptable to me as an elected official. I value a human life more than an animal. That's just common sense. It hurt my heart to not be able to do anything. At the time, we didn't have any police officers too, so we got together as a community and had people patrolling. Because people were scared. Especially the women and children. When people get scared, there's a good chance you're going to have more casualties. And I don't blame people for being scared. Like I said, it's tough to live in a community. What if they took your law enforcement away from your area? Even in just your block that you live on? What if nobody responded? How would you feel? Would you feel safe for your family? No, I'll guarantee you, you wouldn't. Because you're wide open for anybody to come into your house. And no matter who you call, they're not going to respond. That's the way our little communities feel. Myself, I've done police work on and off over the years. I still respond to serious things that happen in our community, even if we have VPSOs, because I know they can't do anything. I do that because I don't want to see anybody else get hurt. People know me. They know I'm not a threat to them. I'm just there to make sure everybody's okay. But I shouldn't have to do that. I'm getting up in age now. You see me, I can't hardly stand up. I'll guarantee you, you get me mad, I'll get up. That's just the way it is. That's why we have to protect our people together. And there's other people in our community to do the same thing. But we shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to have enforcement, law enforcement in our communities. Just as well as you have where you live. I'll guarantee you it's no fun when you don't have somebody out there that's looking out for you. I don't mind it, but, you know, I'm me. But I'll guarantee you there's a lot of single ladies, and, you know, that are scared. So, like I said, we've been talking about this issue for how many years now? How many more people are going to die? How many more of our tribal citizens are going to die because of lack of law enforcement? Enough is enough. I heard all kinds of answers today. Budget issues. Okay, how much is a human life worth? You tell me. I'm sorry, I'm not cutting down anybody any way or means or anything. Yourself, our Alaska State Troopers, our BPSOs, I know what it is to be a police officer. So, it's just been weighing heavy on my mind to worry every night about what may happen. We had 2 active shooters in our community over the last year. The last 2 years. But there was nobody to respond. So I responded to him because, like I say, I didn't want anybody else to get hurt. And thankfully, nobody did. But the potential is there. I had one dispatcher ask me, "Aren't you scared?" I said, "Of course I'm scared. I'm human. But I have to go. I have to respond." That, you know, that fear can make you, you know, not do anything. I don't for me. But it's just, like I say, I shouldn't have to do it. I shouldn't have to do this. Back when I was a police officer, I was a police force of 1, sometimes 2. But I worked by myself mainly off and on for 3 years before I quit. So, and what drove me out of law enforcement was 15 suicides in my little village in 1 year. 15. I had seen enough, so I moved on. So there's a lot of trauma, just like the lady before me had said, in our little villages. A lot. And it's hard to sit here year after year. I've testified in front of many, many panels across Alaska about this very issue. It never gets any easier, I'll tell you. Because my heart is with my people, our native people. But we can't let anything stop us moving forward all the time. And I'm always looking for partners, whether it be the state, the federal, anybody that can help us. I'm not opposed to it. Because the number one concern is the safety, the public safety of our people. So, I appreciate your time today, and I met with quite a few of you today. And I thank the Native Movement and the other organizations that brought me here. Because this is a very important issue. It's not going to go away. As long as we don't have law enforcement in our communities, we'll continue to lose people. So I thank you again for allowing me this time to tell my story, because I've told this story many, many times. One day I hope I don't have to say or tell the story again. I hope that's my greatest hope, is to make sure all our people are protected. Not just my Native people, but everybody, because we do have non-Natives living in our community. So it's important that if it's funding, budgeting, whatever the problem may be, that we find a way around it. I think working with tribes as the state of Alaska, if you look at all the 229 tribes in Alaska, how many millions of dollars we bring in, how many programs we have in our communities. Just think, if we weren't there, we weren't bringing that we weren't getting that money from the government, who would have to foot the bill for all the programs we have? It'd be the state of Alaska. So I think it would be the best interest of everybody involved if we could find a way to come together and pool our resources to fix these issues that we're facing. Because like I say, I don't care who I partner with as long as it benefits my people. And I'm not looking for just a short-term solution. I'm looking for a long-term, and that way I can step aside and maybe retire. So thank you again. I enjoyed talking with you today and visiting with my friends from Native Movement and Murdered and Missing Indigenous Woman. And like I say, hopefully one day I won't be here telling my story, that we can fix these issues that are facing our small rural communities. And it's just not my community, but all across Alaska. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, President Jackson, for your remarks this afternoon, but also for your service to your communities. I can't thank you enough for the story that you shared today, representing the Lower Kuskokwim. Despite being very far away, I think our communities have a lot of the same issues. So I feel that with your remarks, very well represented. So thank you very much for that. Are there any questions for President Jackson before moving to our next presenter? Representative Vance.
Hopefully I'm not always the only one, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Jackson, thank you. I want to tell you that you coming back and telling your story, that you were heard in the first Tribal Affairs Committee, because it is your story of recounting about the young girls in your community standing vigil at the church, keeping watch over her body, was seared in my memory. And it highlighted the importance of why VPSOs and troopers are needed in all of the communities. So know that you did make an impact, and that since that time, there has been an increase in the recruitment of troopers and VPSOs. And that's something that I think so many of us in the legislature are committed to doing, because the need has become so apparent because of people like you speaking up and making a voice. So I just want to acknowledge you were heard the first time, but I do have a question. Part of what we're seeing is we fund positions for troopers and VPSOs. There's a nationwide shortage. When it comes to VPSOs, the most effective person in the villages is going to be a tribal member who is a VPSO because of the relationships and the trust. Have you seen an increase in among tribal members who want to be a part of law enforcement? Because I think that's part of what we're trying to solve is that relationship that's so important, and getting members a part of the program.
Well, thank you for the question. Made me smile, because if you ever lived in a small community like mine, I think the lady before me mentioned it, there's not too many people that will step up in the community to be law enforcement. I did it when I was very young, and it didn't really matter what anybody said to me. I'd do my job. But there's not many people like that out there that will do that job because of the criticism and everything else, you know, like, oh, you know, you're treating my family different because you're not your family. And it's hard to do that job. And if you want to do it right, you have to treat everybody the same. So right now, we got one person that came all the way from Florida to be our VPSO. He was hired probably about a month ago. He didn't have no previous law enforcement. He was a paramedic when he was down there. And then we just got another one. I don't know where he came from. I never talked to him. But unfortunately, that's what we have to work with. And today was mentioned many times, too, is we have to have cultural training for these people that are coming from Florida or wherever, so they know who Native people are, how things are in our villages. I do that. When I first meet them, I sit down and talk with them and tell them how things are in the village. This is how it is. Because I don't want them. Because a lot of people, like I said, I don't like to knock law enforcement, because I was one. But there's some people that have the attitude they're going to come in and they're going to save you. Right? They're going to come in and save you. And they'll make everybody miserable. I told them, you do that, you're not going to last long. Unfortunately. I told them the key to being a police officer, any police officer, is respect. You have to have the respect of the people that you're working with. So, long answer, but
Any further questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, less of a question, more of a comment. I'd like to say thank you, President Jackson, for your comments and for anyone else who I haven't had the chance to speak with. Spoke with the group this morning. But coming from Kotzebue and being a former member of the Native Village of Kotzebue Tribal Council, it's important for me to always advocate for strengthening our tribal courts, looking into tribal police officers, and for the VPSO programs, for those of you in the room representing public safety, Department of Corrections, whoever it might be. One example from my neck of the woods is we have a new VPSO that will be in the community of Norvik, who is originally from Oklahoma. He is indigenous to that state and has served as a tribal police, a BIA safety officer, police officer. And despite not being from rural Alaska, does understand indigenous people and indigenous cultures. And to what you said about understanding the people you're working with and respecting them, I think that's paramount that we make sure that message gets across, because the way that I, as a person from Kotzebue, may be different from the way that someone from Fairbanks or the peninsula communicates, someone from Florida, as you mentioned. So whatever we can do from our side to help advocate and make sure that people have the resources to do that, cultural, embracing the culture of the place that they're trying to serve and protect, I'm an advocate for, and thank you again for your time here today.
Representative Dibert.
Anna Bossi, for your story. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, and so this is very near and dear to our community, this epidemic, I guess you would say. But a question that came up to me was, you know, we talk about cultural training and getting folks from outside into our small communities. Any thoughts on or what's happening with training our youth? Or getting scholarships to get criminal justice training, or sending our youth to get to a program where they can get training on that end and then coming back to our communities. I don't know if that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, so like I say, we're looking at all possibilities on trying to, you know, solve this problem. I know law enforcement is very short-staffed all across the United States, not just in Alaska. So we're always looking for some way to help ourselves if we can get somebody to go to like a tribal police officer academy or, you know, a VPSO academy. But unfortunately, like I say, and I'm not knocking my people, I understand how they feel about not wanting to be part of the law enforcement. So it's just, you know, you got to want to do it. And that's the big part about it. So it's hard to do it.
Follow up, Representative Dibert.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, just another comment. When it comes to policing, any kind of law enforcement, first responding in our smaller communities, this is something that I've wrestled with back in Kotzebue. It's hard for anyone to want to police their own community, to the points that President Jackson brought up about you're arresting your uncle, you're stopping your cousin, you're doing things that are hard to do. And so that is one of the things that I think, before we start training people to become a law enforcement, a public law enforcement officer, before we start looking into funding for sending people to training, I think it's really important to just have that base foundation of having the healthy families and the healthy communities that want to protect their own. So going kind of a backdoor route, making sure that we're doing everything we can to support our young people and support the people of our communities so that they will want to protect our own.
The
Thank you, Representative Baker. Seeing that there are no comments or questions, President Jackson, I want to thank you again for your remarks this afternoon. If you could stick around, we might have some questions that come up at the end. Otherwise, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your time, and thank you for listening. That's an important issue.
Next, joining us at the table, we will have Commissioner Cockrell from the Department of Public Safety.
Through the chair, good afternoon. I'm James Cockrell. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Public Safety. I will say I testify fairly often at these hearings, and this is probably the most nervous I've been in the last 3 years because of the importance of the issues that we're discussing today. It certainly resonates within our department and our communities around the state. I will like to pigtail off of President Jackson's statements. You know, for, I'll say since statehood, the state has followed a false path on how we provide law enforcement services around this state. We've certainly have disproportionate resources in rural Alaska, and it's shameful. And we can probably start tracking that down from the pipeline era when we started getting wealth and more people moved to the state. And the department in the state was focused on providing more police services to our boroughs that are unwilling to pay taxes for law enforcement resources when they have the ability to do it, which would allow the Alaska State Troopers to be in a lot more places than we are right now. I mean, it's shameful. All the victimization that's happened since at least the pipeline era, since I've been with the troopers, is I don't know how we can justify the direction the state has taken by providing those resources that are needed in our rural communities. And I just, you know, I think those are pretty strong statements, but I certainly believe them. I believe them more than I ever have. And when I look at the amount of resources we put in the Mattsu Valley and elsewhere in this state, and we're not doing that in other areas of the state, somewhere somebody's got to figure it out. And certainly I don't have the power to do that. And this is certainly probably not a comfortable conversation to have. But with that said, I know that we're pretty much running out of time. I will say the department is focused on the NYP issues. We put a lot of resources. We meet with essentially all the groups. We've met with the federal government. The federal government originally funded the first NYP investigator for our department. You know, when I came back to the department is when I'll say the NYP issue really was starting to resonate in the state. And I knew fairly quickly that we had to do something. And I didn't really understand the scope of the issue till I actually hired one investigator, and she basically could not handle the amount of requests that were occurring around the state, and it certainly was an eye-opener for me. And so we went from one to she ended up leaving because of the amount of workload that she had in a short period of time. So we ended up hiring two. We're currently at four. And I will say that we're currently working on six, what I'll call cold case missing Indigenous person investigations in four regions of the state. I don't really want to go into more details than that. Our investigators are very active. They've received a lot of support around the communities, from phone calls to interviews to meeting, going to the villages and meeting the folks that are missing their loved ones for one reason or another. And the department will stay focused on that issue because it will be an issue probably at least in my lifetime as an Alaska State Trooper in this position. which after today might end up fairly quickly. So I've kind of just went all over the board. I didn't really have a presentation. I just wanted to know that, you know, we're, it is a super important position or issue that we'll continue to focus on. We'll focus the resources. You see in the governor's budget, he's fully funding the four investigators, providing additional funding for outreach, where we can do outreach and educate folks that do have issues, you know, where they end up losing a loved one. And I will say that a lot of this came from the MMIP working group under the governor's first initiative, and we'll continue to focus on it, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. I've got several pages, but I think we're short of time.
I just want to note, Commissioner Cocker, we still have about an hour if we need it.
I thought we were done at 4:30.
Yeah.
I was told 4:30. So
I stand corrected. I do think ending in a half hour would be good. I know a lot of folks here in attendance have an event that starts. So thank you for being cognizant of the time. But please, I cut you off. I apologize, Commissioner Cockrell, if you...
Through the chair, Representative Carrick.
Representative Carrick.
She looked like she wanted to ask me a question.
Thank you. You can, if you have additional remarks, I'd love to hear them. I didn't mean to cut you off, Commissioner. I am curious, just through the chair, to any of the presenters today. We've talked a little bit about this idea of additional tribal sovereignty and having tribal sovereignty over cases. And I'm just curious, from the perspective of any of our presenters today and from your perspective at DPS, how can the state legislature best support that type of effort? It sounds like, from everyone's perspectives, it would be very valuable to have additional sovereignty. But I just wonder what that looks like in Alaska, specifically, too, when we think about our communities with 500 people, for example, in CAKE, or our communities with such a small number of people wanting to be involved in law enforcement. So what does that pathway look like to getting closer to that goal? And that's a question for anybody here today.
All right. To the chair, Representative Carey. That is a fairly complex issue, tribal sovereignty within in the state. I do see huge changes in the future. I do see additional tribal police officers being funded by the federal government with more authority than the traditional tribal police officers that we currently have right now. The department is exploring different avenues to address that as that comes fruition. And I do know once, you know, and I'm going kind of off the cuff here. I didn't expect this question, and it is a complex question that probably at some point law is going to have to chime in on. But I do see a new beginning when it comes to native-on-native crime and how that is handled versus state court in certain jurisdictions in certain areas of the state that have established tribal courts that have currently the Murkowski's bill, where they have a prosecutor, a defense attorney, and at some point either they're going to probably have to contract with corrections if they decide they got a prison term, or they'll have to build their own. For what I call low-level misdemeanor, you know, the troopers in certain areas of the state are already handling a lot of those in tribal courts, whether that's, you know, a theft in the village or something where they're asked to go catch fish or cut firewood or, you know, something that's productive for the village, but yet has some kind of sanction for that activity. So we're starting to see more and more of that. We're seeing that more acceptance within the department itself and in our smaller communities. I don't know if that totally answers your question, but that's the best I can do.
Follow up, Representative Carrick.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I appreciate that perspective. I guess there's a lot I'd like to learn more about this, especially for higher level crimes too, and what that could look like for tribes. especially in our communities in Alaska, where folks tend to know everybody, you know, everybody knows everybody. So I know that's an ongoing challenge for the victims too. So just a comment that it'd be great to learn more about that from the perspective of the tribes in particular. And I think the coordination with DPS is really, really important, and DOC and other entities as we approach that issue. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Rev. Carrick. I do want to note that our guests were planning on leaving 3 minutes ago. But I hate to end any conversation and stop any questions. And so I want to continue this dialogue right now. If there are any questions or comments for the Representative Vance, please go right ahead.
Thank you. As you know, this is an important issue to me. And I realize sitting at this table that Representative Carpenter and I are the most senior members who have seen the changes in the last 5 going on 6 years now in DPS in the response to this outcry from rural Alaska. And I just feel that you deserve public recognition as the commissioner of DPS for making this change happen. You have brought integrity back to DPS and have prioritized rural Alaska and the changes within the department that was absolutely needed, that brought the cultural shift inside the department that I specifically see, because I sat in this first Tribal Affairs Committee 5 years ago hearing the outcry, but there was a tension within DPS regarding DPSOs that was tangible. And with you returning to the department as the commissioner, I want to say thank you, because you have not only made the voices heard, but done everything that you can to implement the changes, to provide the solutions that it was feeling very one-sided in the legislature. And I think the reports that I'm hearing throughout the department with you being at the helm is very, very positive. And we're seeing that within the rural communities. I now have a VPSO in Soldovia through the new program. And they are saying that as a VPSO, the respect that they have from the troopers as an equal and the amount of support that they have as a VPSO in the partnership is great. And that was not the case prior to you being the commissioner. So I just want to publicly say thank you, because you are what has needed all these years to be able to make the change. We can mandate from the legislature changes all we want, but it takes an individual to create that attitude shift within the department that makes it a positive thing, that says you want to help every Alaskan. And I've seen that, and you have my utmost respect. So thank you.
Representative, I don't say I'm very humbled. You know, when you, and I'm kind of, I'll go off a little bit here. When you listen to the stories, and I have meetings, I've been to a lot of villages, I've been to CAKE, and you hear the victimizations and the trauma that's in those communities, and all they want is a VPSO or an Alaska State Trooper, or they would like both, and you can't give it to them. And you know that certainly they need, I'm wearing essentially a VPSO vest that was actually given to me by the coordinator from Tlingit Haida today. So I thought I'd represent not only the VPSO program, but the Alaska State Troopers. It changes your perception in law enforcement. It cannot help not change. And I look at the felony sex reports for your district. It's the highest in the state. It's higher than per capita than Anchorage by far. Northwest Arctic Borough is like the second. And those folks, because of the lack of resources they have after the investigation, they will suffer from those attacks for the rest of their lives, whether it's in Anchorage but or in our communities. So our focus as a department has been focused towards providing more resources for our rural areas, and however we can do it. We struggle with housing. currently we're struggling with attracting troopers. We have 142 MOUs with tribes that want a VPSO. Currently, I think we have 50-some villages that we're covering with VPSOs. We've been able to take the VPSO bill and have two VPSOs versus one. That way that we don't have burnout all the time. And sure, are we bringing in some people in from outside the state? Yes, we are. I don't know how to. We're doing the same thing with the Alaska State Troopers. I went to the academy in 1983. All of us, there were 38 recruits in that class, and all of us were Alaska residents. I'm lucky to get a 50-50 split right now or less with non-residents versus Alaska residents. And it does make a difference because it bonds them to the state. They understand the culture of the state. There's just so many good things that happen, and I'm not putting down people that come up from Lower 48. They've made some really great troopers. But if someone gets sick from their family or something, and the next thing you know, they go back to Texas or Oklahoma or wherever they came from. And it's a, you know, it's incumbent on us, not only just, you know, me or the department, it's incumbent on all of us to try to encourage our Alaskans to be a VPSO. Or an Alaska State Trooper. Being an Alaska State Trooper is so rewarding. This uniform signifies so much in this state. If we go into a community, they know it's an Alaska State Trooper, not any other police department in the state. They know it's an Alaska State Trooper, and it means something. It still does after all these years. My dad started in 1963 as a State Trooper, worked the Tanana River as a rural unit out of Fairbanks. You know, we're still doing that. 40 years later, I'm still doing it there. So I know I'm going way off. I certainly appreciate your comments. And I've known Tammy Drew for a long time and talked to Kendra. And, you know, we're trying to make a difference. We really are. Progress sometimes isn't as quick as we'd like to do it because we run on yearly cycles and four-year cycles, depending on who the administration is. The previous administration was very supportive of tribal issues. However, they weren't willing to fund them, so it really didn't help us. Here we have a willingness to deal with tribal issues, and certainly we've gotten support that we've never had as a department, to my knowledge, over the last, with the support of the legislature and the current administration, we've really gained as a department. We have really good positive momentum for change, and I hadn't seen that my whole career, and I'm 32 years in June will be how many years I've had with the department. And so we are, as a state, going in the right direction. I see the tide changing where there's more resources and more willingness to put resources in rural parts of the state and spend money to put housing for troopers and teachers and OCS, all the other agencies that are involved in that area. We just have to keep focused on it. And that's not only my job, but that's also your guys' job to make our state better for when we leave public office, or if I leave this, we're better off. You know, that's what I'm trying to do, is leave this department better off than when I found it. And I think, again, we have a positive direction. We know where we want to go as a department. If we could hire more troopers, we'd be knocking it out of the box, but we haven't got there yet. But I just ask people to have faith in us. We are committed. Our troopers are totally dedicated. They care about their people. They care about the job they're doing. Do we make them screw up? Absolutely. And I'll own up to every one of them, because we're not perfect. And we've made mistakes since I've been commissioner, and we've owned up to those mistakes. But our ultimate goal is to provide professional law enforcement resources that's equal around the state. And that's all I'm asking for. No matter how small or big your village is. Because we've always, and if I'm getting too long, let me know. Because here's what we do as a department, then doing it forever is, we'll go into a place, we'll look how much crime is in City 8. So say we're having, you know, we got 50 felony cases in a year. So we put a trooper there, a VPSO there. In 2 years, how many crime? That 50 goes down to 3. So what do we do? Well, there's no crime there, we move our people out. And then the next thing you know, the crime goes up. Because we do know, once you put a VPSO or a trooper in the village, things will just stay kind of even until they trust that person. They have to bond with the community. And then you start seeing the arrests maybe going up a little bit. We'll see a spike in crime. But what we'll see is a leveling off, and then we'll see a decrease in crime because they know that the VPSO or the troopers there, they're going to take care of business, and they're part of that community. I know that one VPSO for sure probably would have been shot had he not been a VPSO in that village because two troopers died in that shooting. I know that I just know that would have happened. Because he was engaged in that community, so they took him differently. And it is difficult, as the president said, to have somebody from the village police the village. That was the original concept of the VPSO program 40 years ago, find people within the village and then make them VPSOs. There was a willingness to do it in the beginning, and then what we started doing was that wasn't working because there was either they weren't staying or there was conflict because they are interrelated. So we started moving them to other villages in the same area. So the YK Delta, we moved them to another village there. And that worked for a while, and then that kind of fell apart. And then we were just having issues trying to structure the program. So what we've done just recently is instead of the VPSO program, it's actually the VPSO division. So we made a division within the Department of Public Safety with a director that's at the same level as the director of the Alaska State Troopers, the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. So there's parity. So they can share resources. It puts the importance of the VPSO program because now it's under also, since I've been back, it's been under the commissioner's office. So there's that direct communication down from the commissioner's office with the commissioner's priority, whether it's me or somebody else. And then also he's on par with the colonels of the Alaska State Troopers and Alaska Wildlife Troopers, which means better coordination, hopefully a better product, plus also the troopers understand the importance that we have on the program. And as you say, we're seeing huge results in the interaction between the troopers and the VPSOs. I know we kind of went way off topic.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Vance.
No, thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
At the risk of opening a can of worms, is it time yet to have a conversation about local municipalities taking on responsibility for local policing that the state troopers are currently providing?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, absolutely. I think there's also the ability, like the Royal Canadian Mounted Police does, where if they don't want to fund their own police department, they can contract out to the Alaska State Troopers. It's pretty common in the lower 48 with the Sheriff's Department. But, you know, I live in the city of Soldotna. I pay Soldotna tax, and I got the city of Soldotna PD in my jurisdiction, right? You should pay for those costs. You look at the amount of resources, and I don't mean to pick on the Mattsu Valley, but we pay for dispatch services, almost $2 million. We're dispatching primarily in the Mattsu borough. Some of it's outside. I understand that we should pay for areas of the state that they're dispatching that's outside the borough, but they're receiving 911 surcharges and all that. Why are we paying them $2 million to provide dispatch services? I could say the same thing with all the office leases we have in the Mattsu Valley. We don't have very many on the Kenai Peninsula Fair Range because we have our own post, but one of our biggest leases is outside by Big Lake in our department. And when you start knocking it away, we're paying, not including wages and stuff, because I got about 50 troopers on patrol, half a dozen CSOs, court service officers, and we've got our major crime investigators, including our crimes against children, which we're going to hopefully put in Bethel this year, crime against children investigators in the valley. So when you start adding all that up, you got to think about, is there a better way to do it? Right now they're complaining because our services are down. Yeah, they're down because we're down vacancies. We patrol an area the size of West Virginia or Arkansas. It just depends on what state you like the most. They have their growth has outpaced our ability to keep up with that growth. So not only that, the funding has not been always available to provide trooper support in there. Again, the previous administration cut about 40 trooper positions. Well, those had to come from somewhere. And then we have about 112,000 people outside in Mattsu Borough. And so the cities are small. The city of Wausau, in my opinion, has cherry-picked the areas that they want to make their boundaries. where they don't have to take more of the hardcore areas that the troopers take. So, so absolutely, it's time for a discussion on it. I mean, we've closed our eyes. We've allowed rural Alaska just to continue the way it is, where we got people victimized every day, seriously victimized. So absolutely.
I follow up.
Follow up, Rip Carpenter.
I, for a number of years since I've been in the legislature, been convinced, might not be the right word, but just pretty sure that a community-oriented policing model is probably going to be the most effective. Meaning we have a system set up where law enforcement can establish relationships with people in the community, and we're able to influence before crime happens instead of just responding to it happening, which is kind of what I think the state troopers do on a very large, big picture, is just respond. It's interesting to hear you say that in some villages or rural Alaska, that having locals do the policing presents a challenge for that, in that model, in that concept of community-oriented policing, and then having a trooper who isn't actually from the village but is trusted by the village is actually maybe a better model. I'm wondering, does that mean that it must be a state agency? Or if we had a law enforcement model similar to what other states have at the borough or county level, that is focused on local issues, that we would have better results from that. And I don't know that there's another state out there that does law enforcement the way that we do it for the large areas that we have. Maybe the state troopers is the best model. State police force is the best model for rural Alaska. But I can't imagine that just reacting to crime in more urban areas is the best way to do the policing in the urban areas. That a community-oriented policing model would be better suited for those areas. And we ought to be having that conversation of how to shift to that over the next decade or so that it would take to make something like that happen. I appreciate that you're talking about the finances piece. I was thinking of it from a conceptual, what's the best model to use for policing? And I think we can figure out how to pay for it. But
yeah, through the chair, I'll try to answer that question. First of all, the Alaska State Troopers were never designed to be an urban law enforcement agency. They were designed to take care of areas off the road system or on the road system, like Delta, Glen Allen, Tok, and then the other regions of the state. I will say that if the department were growing to the level that we think it should be, at least providing adequate law enforcement resources, because right now we don't even think we're doing adequately the job that we are assigned to do. We could probably get to it where you're at, where we have more direct interactions with the public. Our troopers would stay longer in those communities, and we would be more community-orientated police. But realistically, right now, we're totally in a reactionary mode. It doesn't matter where we're out of the state because of our numbers. We're totally reactionary. We disinvolved during the previous administration most of our proactive units, like our Borough Highway Patrol that was focused on reducing highway deaths on our highways, and was very successful. We had 22 positions in that borough, and focused strictly on DUI. If patrol picked up a crash or a DUI, they would show up, they'd take over the crash, and they would take the drunk to the jail. Well, that frees up our trooper to go back doing trooper work. So I know that a few weeks or a month ago or so, I spent an evening out on patrol in the Matsu Valley, 8 hours. We had 4 arrests, wrestled with the guy that was high or drunk or whatever. I had a death investigation. So all those 4 arrests in 8 hours, plus a death investigation. We searched a drug house because of adult probation thought we had, whether it was drugs or this person wasn't there. So we had all this stuff going. So that trooper's, it's kind of like taking moves. Once you take the moves, the work starts. So you got to go back to the office. You got to do your criminal complaints. You got to write your reports. You got to get it done in time before your shift to get it out to the DA's office for prosecution. Currently, our troopers in the valley have a caseload of over 100 open cases per trooper. And there's no way they can ever catch up. They become, unless it happens right there, they become report writers. And that's, we're trying to, again, and our budget asks for the last 2 years has been focused on administrative support to take that burden, because there's a lot of, unfortunately, I don't know why, but there's a lot of administrative functions that an Alaska State Trooper does that shouldn't do. So we're trying to take that load away to keep that person in the field. Same with the the crimes against children. We're getting those investigated, but currently in Bethel, there are uniform troopers, and I want those troopers to stay in the field, stay in the villages to reduce the crime in the villages, and then have additional investigators just investigate sexual assault of minor cases. And that way we get a unit that's investigating those cases, and then we push our patrol guys, they're not really patrolling Bethel, they're all doing investigation, but our uniform guys into our villages. That's where we want them. We don't want them sitting in Bethel writing reports. We want them out in our communities.
Representative Baker, Representative Divert, I wanted to afford you the opportunity to ask any questions that you might have as we are kind of running up to our time this evening.
I just would like to say thank you. Thank you for being here. And just, I learned something new, and I have some thoughts down the road, and it's just great to meet you. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Through the chair, just in closing, thank you, Commissioner, and everyone who's spoken. And I appreciate wrapping up, because I do have a 5 o'clock meeting. But whatever we can do, the District 40 door is open, and I'm pretty sure everybody's doors are open, open to suggestions, open to continuing the conversation. So thank you, Chair McCormick, for hosting this today and making sure that these stories were told and that we're able to hear what's going on across the state.
Any questions or comments from any other members? Commissioner Cockerlone, I thank you very much for what you alluded to. I recall the first time you came into my office, I think you said essentially the same thing about, or really you apologized for the abysmal lack of resources for our community, communities for that matter. So I thank you for that. But I also just want to caution all of this by saying that we're still in the midst of this pandemic that we see here before us. There's still many families who report incidences and are ignored. So your acknowledgement is very well taken, but at the same time, I just want to say that things still need to change. Things still need to get better. I think back to a question that someone asked during the Mental Health Trust visit. I think you were there and you might recall this. An individual from Nebuskiak asked, I believe it was Representative Prox, why do we have to compete to feel safe? Why do they? Why do they? That's a question that I will ask myself every time I'm in one of these committees, every vote I take on public safety. So I'm a little all over the place, and frankly, this is a little personal and emotional, so I apologize for that. But I just want to thank you for what you've said, and I'm really looking forward to putting in the necessary work to fill in these gaps and to keep all of our communities safe. Because as far as I'm concerned, until we really solve this issue, we're all responsible for this. This is on our watch. So thank you very much, Commissioner Cockrell. We have a lot of work to do. So thank you very much. I just one more time want to open up the floor if anyone has any comments or remarks before we conclude. Hearing none. I want to thank all of our presenters this afternoon. I want to thank the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, the Department of Public Safety, MMIP G2S Working Group, and Data for Indigenous Justice for your presentations today and for flying out here to Juneau.
The House Tribal Affairs Committee will meet again on Wednesday, February 7th at 3:30 p.m. The time is 4:58 p.m., and this hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee is now adjourned.